Beware those who claim to know the mind of God, writes Barbara Brown Taylor. Beware those who claim to know the mind of God and who are prepared to use force, if necessary, to make others conform. Beware those who cannot tell God's will from their own. Temple police are always a bad sign. The Pharisees and scribes in today's gospel weren't temple police, but they acted like it. After all, there were, in all fairness, things to protect. The tradition of the elders, the foundational Ten Commandments and oral interpretations of Judaism's Mosaic Law. In the passage that Jamie just read, these religious leaders are upset with Jesus and his followers for breaking two of these traditions. The first, eating unclean market food, which means before it was ceremonially blessed, and not washing their hands. In their view, this defiled them. It made them unfit for temple worship. Once again, Jesus was a lawbreaker, and his criminal record, according to them, was a long one. While walking through fields to synagogue on the Sabbath, he'd actually allowed his hungry disciples to pluck corn to eat. Mind you, Deuteronomy 23, verse 25, allowed that, but not according to the Pharisees. By reaping on the Sabbath, you see, they were breaking four of the Pharisees' 39 holy day work rules. And what are those, you ask? Well, no reaping, no winnowing, no threshing, and certainly no meal preparation. Jesus' response was to argue from two precedents, necessities of life and duties of sacred service. After all, I'm sure he reminded them, no less a figure than King David before he was king, and friends had eaten forbidden fruit, in this case bread, to ease their hunger. Then there was a man with the withered hand who begged Jesus to heal him, of course, on the Sabbath, and Jesus did, reminding the temple police that the Sabbath was made for people, not people for the Sabbath. Jesus wasn't in the slightest fastidious about fasting. He touched unclean lepers and broke all sorts of other cleanliness codes. He ate with the impious and the irreligious, and we could go on. All to the horror of the law-loving Pharisees. Jesus accused the Pharisees of hypocrisy by not practicing what they preached. But in all fairness, again, I imagine these religious leaders started out, however far back, with admirable intentions. Most of us do. They wanted to be faithful. The Pharisees were officially keepers of the law. Most decisively and originally, those Ten Commandments believed given by Yahweh to Moses, consisting of both religious and ethical directives. These ten are literally the essence of the Torah and that all-important covenant between God and the people of Israel. And over time, 613 supplemental rules called mitzvot were added, 613, extracted from Hebrew scriptures and covering numerous aspects of daily life. Of those 613, 365 of them were don'ts, such as don't gossip, don't bow down on smooth stones, don't walk more than 2,000 cubits outside the city on Shabbat. And 248 are dues. Leave gleanings for the poor. Sacrifice animals no less than 8 days old. Make a guardrail around flat roofs. It was these sorts of commentaries and clarifications of the Ten Commandments that the Pharisees observed with vigor and denounced Jesus for disregarding. And before seminary and before Hebrew Scriptures studies, I have to admit that I, like many folk, maybe you among them, couldn't help but snicker at some of these legalisms and intricacies. I read only a few. There were 613, remember. They seemed a little much. It helped that one of my professors told us they were what is called a fence around the Torah, a fence, a barrier. Explaining these supplemental rules were like a buffer zone to help keep people from breaking the big Ten Commandments. By delineating such minutiae to do or not do, the faithful were hopefully steered away from violating those supreme no-nos of the Ten Commandments. I personally likened them to those big water-filled bumpers that you see driving down the highway that are in front of bridge supports and other highway hazards, you know? You might hit them, God forbid, yes, but they won't flat out kill you. Regardless of all that, Jesus saw these 600 plus fence laws as anything but faith assisting. The people, you see, had become more familiar with and obedient to them than to God's love undergirding the Ten Commandments, particularly the first two. Judaism embraced commandments 1 and 2, love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself, as the only commandments received directly from God. And Jesus himself proclaimed, on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Together, they summed up all 10. For the Pharisees, though, these rules, these 613, were superior to the reason behind them. For the Pharisees, form had taken over substance. They'd lost the spirit behind these rules, by concentrating on the rules themselves. They'd, in other words, they were worshiping the bath water instead of the baby. So Jesus sternly rebuked them, sternly and repeatedly. The spirit of love has to be the thing that imbues and sustains and enfleshes these laws and be their only purpose. So the Ten Commandments, do not lie, doesn't mean just don't lie about what you say. It means be truthful about everything. Do not steal is more than don't steal. It means be honest about everything. Remember, the Sabbath doesn't mean practice piety and don't do anything at all except that, but rather remember the Sabbath was established to restore and to renew and to rest. Use it faithfully. Law and rules are helpful and important, but the love behind them has to be our focus. Granted, rules can do damage. Rigid stipulations and threats of punishment might help to keep people from killing each other, although crime statistics don't really bear that out. But adhering to the letter of the law won't make any of us godlike. The late Clarence Jordan, author of the Cotton Patch Gospels. Has anybody encountered those? The Cotton Patch? Oh my goodness, you've lived this long without them? Anyway, the Cotton Patch Gospels, you can look it up in the Lesser God Google. He always spoke about inward character as the foundation of faithfulness. Along with Jesus, Jordan maintained that the reason we do something and the way we do it is equally important to what we actually do. And to bring the point home, he'd ask, would chaining a vicious dog to a tree mean that it was suddenly a good dog? Of course not. Because the dog's quote-unquote goodness derived from the strength of its chain. If, however, on the other hand, the dog was made obedient and good, the chain wouldn't be necessary. Point being, externals aren't needed if the internals, the right stuff, is right. And St. Augustine must have known that because he's reputed to have said, and I love this, love God and do as you please. Be careful with that one. For Jesus, love is everything, genuine love. You know, the word love, it's become like, oh gosh, it's one of the most useless words in the English language because it means everything and nothing. I'm sure when you use the word love, it means something, but love has become denigrated to, I don't know, Valentine's Day cards. For Jesus, love meant justice. And love meant mercy. But we have to ask, we really ought to, even at this hour of the morning, what about law? You know, the Pharisees were all about support and reinforcement of the law. What about law and rules that support the Spirit? What is its role and measure? A debate that's still ongoing in certain Christian circles. Some people insist that law was made absolutely obsolete by Jesus' covenant of love. Others insist it's law that matters, creating for many a tit versus tat, love versus law mindset that absolutely misses the point. Let's use an analogy. Law is to love like tracks are to a train. You got that? The train obviously is what's important, but it's pretty useless without tracks to guide it. But on the other hand, tracks without a train to guide are equally useless. They need one another in a healthy tension and balance. Religion and its traditions can and should be good and point others to God, but can also communicate explicitly or implicitly, you don't belong. So, a sincere and faithful question. What about our tension and balance? How do we Anglicans live out this all-important interplay between love and law. In many places, and I sadly don't have to say this, Christians have gained a very well-deserved reputation as legalistic, self-righteous, mean-spirited, and obnoxious folk. Anything but loving. Many who once faithfully belonged to a community, faith community, have come to feel disenfranchised. Some don't participate in church at all, and others say, I am an atheist. The definition of legalism, seeking forgiveness and acceptance through obedience to rules. And the Pharisees were legalists. But true religion, I mean, any true, genuine, faithful religion is not, as you know, preaching, I don't have to preach to the choir. I don't have to preach to you. You know all this. True religion isn't about rules or obedience. It's about love, connectedness, that relationship we've talked about between and among one another and the God who calls us all beloved. No Christian exists to police other Christians, to put law in the role reserved for God's grace and to judge who has it most right and who doesn't. As a writer named Robert Farrar Capone has wisely observed, Christianity is not a religion. It is the announcement of the end of religion. Because religion consists of all the things the human race has ever thought it had to do to get right with God. But the church isn't here to bring the world the bad news that God will think kindly about us only after we've gone through certain creedal, liturgical, and ethical wickets. It's here, he says, to bring the good news that, quote, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. Again, what about us, Anglicans? All of us, not just here in this beautiful church. I came across a placard recently that said, and I'll read it twice because it's tricky, divided we stand. Anglicans need to agree to disagree. Divided we stand. Anglicans need to agree to disagree. That's one of our greatest strengths, if you've thought about it, and one of the strongest reasons that I am a very grateful Anglican. We don't tell other people what to do, or we shouldn't, what to do or not do, what to think or what not to think. After all, we're hardly in a position to. Our beautiful parish, this family of St. John's, embraces diversity. Behold that beautiful rainbow flag, for example. Anglicans have been called people of the book. BAS, BCP, and all the various supplementals that preceded them and will probably follow before the next rendition comes out. But the grandson of the great Gandhi, Mohammed Gandhi, Aaron Gandhi, has pointed out, and I quote him these words, the people of the book risk putting the book before people. Do we put law above love and rules or structures above persons? If we do, social justice just isn't the top of our agenda, and we have some repenting to do. We need always ask ourselves to keep ourselves going in the right direction. Do our traditions of the elders, and we have many as Anglicans, do they help us grow in love of God and neighbor? Or do they manage God and try to control neighbor? Do our traditions welcome, value, and affirm others, or exclude, marginalize, and reject them? In all of this, in light of today's gospel reading, I think it's appropriate to say, would St. John's upset the Pharisees? We would. I know we would. And by God's grace, may we always continue to do so. You can say amen.
Amen.